Hey there, this is Seth Waters from Channel 9 here at the wonderful conference called CodeMash. You've been here for like 50 years, right?
I think I was at the third one or something. I missed last year because I was writing and sort of taking a break from conferences, but I think this is fourth, fifth time.
So I got ahead of myself. This is the prolific John Skeet. If you want to get a hold of him, write something into Stack Overflow. Is that about the short and long of it?
If it's a good question, yeah.
So you have been answering, like, you are the Chuck Norris of Stack Overflow. Let's get into, how did you start doing this? I mean...
So I first heard about Stack Overflow when I was, yeah, I was doing the whole egocentric searching thing. Sure. C# in Depth had just been out for a little while.
Which I purchased, by the way. First and second edition I have.
I'm writing the fourth edition at the moment.
Oh, fantastic.
So Sarah Chips had a review on her blog, and I think it was maybe the next article was something about Stack Overflow. I hadn't been, so I had a look, then looked for any questions about C# in Depth, and then saw, okay, so I answer those. Oh, look, there are some other things I could answer. Hey, this is fun, and this is going to be quite addictive. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I blogged, I think, either the first afternoon or maybe the second afternoon that I'd been using it, saying, I can see this being something I do quite a lot. I don't think I had any idea quite what it turned out to be. But
are you spending like every spare moment of this? I mean, how do you answer so many questions? How do you like put that volume out?
These days I don't even answer that many questions. Okay. I spend probably more time commenting on questions, saying, do you know what, you should really rephrase this question, provide a complete example, mm-hmm. say exactly what's going on. And sometimes I don't hear back, and I would like to think that is because they've then taken the time to come up with a complete example, little console app. I love console apps for demonstrating problems.
Sure.
And in the course of that, usually I find if I've got a problem that I'm going to ask on Stack Overflow, come up with a console app, oh, that's what was wrong. Okay, and now I don't need the question.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll ask the question anyway to sort of say, right, well, this was what I thought, mm-hmm. and this turned out to be the answer. And that kind of thing's great. Just going through that diagnostic process, right. Of if you can, instead of saying, well, something's wrong with this 300 lines of code, well, try to pin it down a bit and make
problem,
it in something that we can all reproduce. You know, don't rely on a file somewhere unless you post the content of that JSON file and then say, right, this is how I'm loading it. Boom. Do it so that we can reproduce it. And then if we can reproduce it, you can reproduce it more easily than normal, and chances are you've already found the solution. So I spend a lot of time encouraging people to put more effort into asking their questions well, at which point I don't need to answer them anymore.
Because at that point, because usually people, I would post a frustration, this isn't working, you know, because at that point you're frustrated, yep. and you're like, well, what isn't working? And if you tease out the actual problem, you probably solve it,
right.
and you'll find out it's something else.
And I think the fact that people do post when they're coming out of a position of frustration leads to bad questions, which leads to people downvoting and closing, mm-hmm. which leads to people being more frustrated, and it's, you'll find loads of blog posts saying Stack Overflow is awful, those terrible moderators and high rep users who just want to make you feel stupid. No, we just want high quality questions. And if you're in a psychological position where you're not ready to ask a question, then sleep on it.
Yeah.
You know, we get some things with awful formatting and say, could you tidy up the formatting? And say, not really, because I'm posting on a mobile. Well, just wait. Wait
yeah.
until you're at a laptop, for goodness sake, it's not that hard. Yeah. I know the whole mobile first thing, but surely not for asking a high quality question.
So in your workflow, are you answering like 10 questions a day?
Workflow.
I mean, I'm trying to understand, like, because I've been to your office, you've told me that you've answered questions on the train.
Oh yeah, so I
stuff.
Still do that. I mean, most of the time these days I work from home, which is awesome.
Awesome.
But I answer questions on the train, I answer questions at work, I answer questions at home. These days I'll answer 3 or 4 questions a day, maybe, you know, if there are that many good questions. Mm-hmm. It used to be sort of 10, 20 questions a day. I don't find as many good C# questions, whether that's partly, you know, C# changes relatively slowly, so there aren't that many new questions about it. I know that originally C# was sort of the highest tag in terms of volume of questions that stayed open, and now I think Java's overtaken it, and certainly JavaScript is... Mm-hmm. Most things are around JavaScript or the libraries, and
right.
you know, often it's not entirely clear, to at least to the questioner, whether we're talking about a language feature or a jQuery feature.
Oh, I see. So what is the hardest question, like a question that you looked at and you're like, huh, I wonder.
Right, so there have been a bunch of those. There was one that was around dynamic typing, and they were doing a double AND, mm-hmm. so the short circuiting AND. And there are some real weirdnesses there. There have been a few questions where I've looked and thought, yeah, I don't know why that's behaving that way. And then I've reported something to the C-sharp design team, and they've sometimes said, yeah, we don't know either. and that's either because, yeah, that's behaving, that's incorrect. Those are the relatively simple ones. Then there's, do you know what? We don't know what the answer should be. we looked at the spec, and it doesn't seem
ambiguous
to cover that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you'd be amazed that the C-sharp spec is written really, really well. Mm-hmm. I think we'll talk later on a bit more about the ECMA standardization stuff. But you'd be amazed at how much even a well-written spec might just miss just those tiny corner cases.
And there's just certain things that you would never expect someone to do. Like, for example, I'd hardly use dynamic.
Right.
And so if you're using it and you're using it in weird ways.
All the rules just change completely when it comes to dynamic. So in the case of this example of dynamic, it was that the short circuiting double ampersand operator evaluates the first operand, and only if that's true does it evaluate the second operand. Well, that sounds fine, but what about some weird cases where the exact operator overload that gets used depends on the type of the second operand? Which, if that's dynamic, the idea is that it will depend on the execution time type. But if you haven't evaluated the operand, you don't know what the type is. So you've either got to break the contract of double ampersand and evaluate it, and it's just,
So what is the weirdest question you've been asked on Sarah?
So depends what you mean by weird. There's one that's my highest upvoted question. So if we have a look at this. Okay. So this is asking why two times in 1927, you know, subtracting one from another gives a strange result, and it's giving sort of that's just under 6 minutes.
Yeah,
and they're meant to be, 1 second apart. And I saw this, and initially, if you look at the edit history, I don't think it specified the time zone. And it's like, I have a feeling I know where this may be, and it was the Shanghai time zone, which, if you look in the 1900s, all the time zones were doing weird stuff because. Countries didn't have whole time zones back in like late 1890s, 1900s. They had their local mean time. And certainly in the UK, there was railway time, which was across the country, and local time. So you would have two clocks in railway stations, one that gave you the local time, and then railway time that all the timetables went to.
Wow.
So weird stuff happened. I'm into Dayton time, so I kind of knew about this. So it was a gift to me as a question.
Nice.
And you know, it's got 8,000 upvotes. Now, an upvote should be saying this is useful. I don't believe this has been useful to 8,000 people. I believe 8,000 people said, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
So it's not useful, but hey. So I knew that happened, and so I added a test in NodaTime. I have, so NodaTime's my .NET Dayton Time replacement API. And we may talk about that a bit later, who knows. So, I have a whole project which is Stack Overflow questions that provide either an example of where date time sucks, or they're just interesting to put. So I put this in, and I did it as a unit test. And then a while ago, in 2013, by the looks of it, looking at the question, it stopped working. The unit test broke, and it's because the history had changed. So I don't know exactly why, but the TCDB, which is the sort of IANA-run time zone database, which you would have thought there would be an official,
right.
a genuine, internationally approved, government-backed kind of thing for time zones, because it's kind of useful to know what the time is in various places. No, it's all kind of volunteer-run and based on volunteers spotting news articles saying that the time zone has changed and trying to find a reputable source. At one point, for I think it was an Egypt change, the most reputable source in English that we could find was the Egyptian government's Facebook page or something like that. It's like, there should be something a bit more formal than this.
We don't even know what time it is sometimes. Yeah. It's crazy.
So this goes back historically, sort of anything before 1970 is sort of best effort kind of thing. But basically, they changed what time it had changed in 1927. I don't know why they changed that, but yeah, it changed. So I had to change my unit test, and I edited the question, and then it happened again. So yeah, that was kind of weird.
Let's pause right here. Edit point. I'm going to put this on your lap. Edit point. She'll be on the screen, and we'll come out of the screen.
Okay.
Edit point. Just for you. All right, so this is the weirdest question. You talked about the hardest question. Any interesting, fun, other things about Stack Overflow you'd like to share?
I think the main message I want to get out about Stack Overflow is it is a fabulous resource. Sure. If you've had negative experiences, then it's possible that there were some grumpy people who downvoted you. There will always be sort of false positives for mm-hmm. closing and downvoting. But not in the heat of the moment, but taking couple of weeks later, look back and say, is that the best question I could have asked? Could I have done some more research? Could I have shown my research? Could I have shown, you know, not here's 300 lines of code, but here's a 10-line console app. I don't care that you saw it in Windows Forms. It wasn't about Windows Forms, so here's a console app that shows it as neatly as possible. Is this a polished work of art of a question?
Nice.
Put some time in. Think, if 10,000 people see this and that's all they know about me, are they going to have a positive impression? And it takes work. And I really don't mind that it takes work, because it's meant to be, Stack Overflow is meant to be this repository of high quality questions and answers. The goal isn't to answer your question. It's to have a really good question that someone else can find later on. If I can help you today, that's great. If I can help 10,000 people in the next 10 years, that's so, so much
right.
better. And you know, imagine something that saves 10,000 people 1 second. How much of your time are you worth? Are you willing to put into saving those 10,000 seconds?
And what's amazing is that there is code from Stack Overflow in almost all big projects.
It's amazing and you know, kind of scary. I've got some questions where I've said, well, there's an answer to this. Do not use this code. It's awful. You should design around this problem.
Sure.
But here's something that's kind of fun for a bunch of different things for overload resolution for generic types and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, there's definitely code that shouldn't be there. Hopefully I've normally labeled my code saying stop, do not use.
Yeah,
and
I've seen that actually.
Yeah, if you do use it, don't blame me.
So if you want to get a hold of John Skeet, ask a well thought out, carefully crafted masterpiece of a question, and then by that time you'll probably already have the answer.
Yeah, but if it's a really interesting question, just ask it anyway.
Yeah.
Certainly if it's something about, well, I couldn't understand why C# acted in this way. So I looked through the specification and you know, maybe you'll self-answer and say, yeah, I needed to look through this section, then this section, then this section, then this section. And if it was about type inference, then you know, you have my deepest sympathies.
Yeah,
you know, self-answer, answer saying, I looked in the specification, I looked in this section, I couldn't find anything. That's all fine.
Awesome. So let's move on to the next topic I want to talk to you about. Recently at the event we had in New York, it was Connect in New York, Google, because you work for Google, Google joined the .NET Foundation and part of the steering committee,
yeah.
right? And Chris Sells mentioned to me that you were actually on the steering committee.
It wasn't yes, him, it was, which is awesome.
So
I think Chris is in as well.
Yeah.
So this actually came out over a lunch with Martin Woodward. Awesome guy.
Yeah, fantastic.
And he was in London and he was in the Google office. I said, yeah, come, we'll have lunch. He's previously come to give a tech talk with Mads Torgersen, talking about how they found working in open source in C# and all kinds of things. So yeah, awesome guy. He came, we had lunch, we talked about what I'm doing. I'm working on Google Cloud Platform for C# developers. Mm-hmm. So that is clearly relevant to Microsoft. How .NET Core being open, really open, not just kind of fake open,
yeah.
but really open, makes a huge difference and makes our life better in Google.
Sure.
So it means that we can provide a much better offering to .NET developers. And so I think everyone wins. We were saying how awesome this was, talking about the .NET Foundation and you know some of the projects that it's running, talking about whether Node at Time would fit in with the foundation. You know, are there benefits, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, wouldn't it be fun? Wouldn't it just be really fun if Google were in the .NET Foundation? I say, yeah, that, actually, I know you were saying it in jest, but that makes a lot of sense. And I thought, yeah, actually, it really does.
Yeah, it does.
It really does. It's for everyone's benefit. And I think it's a wonderful new world.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly feels to me like we have a new Microsoft.
Sure.
Microsoft seems to have changed its tack a lot. Mm-hmm. And Google is definitely recognizing the needs of .NET developers and Windows developers in general more. And these are both great things, and we can cooperate and we can still compete. It would be terrible if we decided, I'm not going to speculate around legal matters, but I wouldn't want Microsoft to say, we'll have all the Windows developers, and Google say, yeah, that's fine, and tell you what, we'll have all the Linux developers in our cloud. Yeah, that would be not good.
It wouldn't serve the needs of the developers.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't know details, despite working on Google Cloud Platform. I can't tell you all the marketing spiel about why GCP is so much better than Azure, so much better than AWS, etc. And if I did tell you, you wouldn't believe me. You know, that's a marketing. I'm at lower level things, but I could well believe that there are some tasks which are better suited for Azure, and some tasks, obviously most tasks, better suited for Google Cloud Platform.
Of course,
and maybe even some for AWS. But if we assume that is the case, without looking for evidence either way, then doesn't it help if you can use that from any language?
Yeah.
So my job is to make C# awesome on GCP. And yeah, it helps to be part of the steering group. I've only attended one meeting so far, but it's fabulous to hear about what other companies are doing, hear about some of Microsoft's plans, and we can share customer feedback and saying, you know, it would be really helpful for us if .NET could enable this scenario. And my guess is that when we raise something like that, Microsoft is likely to say, do you know what, that's something that would help our customers as well, and it can just help everyone. So it's a really good thing.
And this isn't the first time that Google and Microsoft has collaborated when it comes to, for example, Angular and TypeScript. That's the beginning of it. And it seems like it all floats around these language needs of people wanting to write something in a language they like.
I think it's when you get software engineers together. Yeah. When I've never been around sales engineers from Microsoft and Google together, but my guess is that there may be more hostility because you know they're actively competing against each other in bids and whatever. If you get software engineers together from Google and Microsoft, we'll have a whale of a time.
It's true.
I have a lot of good friends in Microsoft, and one of the highlights of CodeMash is usually hanging out with Dustin Campbell, Kevin Pilch, Bisson, and you know, just talking about awesome stuff about what's going on in C#. Sadly, they're not here this year.
Yeah, I know.
And Bill Wagner, normally, I'm seeing him next week, so that's not so bad.
Awesome.
But yeah, I have a load of good friends in Microsoft. They have a load of good friends in Google. We can work together, and it sounds really tacky. Work together and make the world a better place. But it's true. It's true. So I'm hoping that as part of the .NET Foundation, we can help to be part of that.
So speaking about this, you're on the steering committee. What are some things about .NET, C# that you would like to see?
Well, I'd like to see the .NET core tooling done and stable.
Yes,
everyone would.
Me too.
Yeah. Another thing I would like, maybe it's a pipe dream, but I think the state of documentation is fairly awful. Yeah. If I write some code, I would like there to be better, more standardized, simpler ways of producing API reference documentation, conceptual documentation, being able to link between those, and not just for C#, but if I'm developing an API, as in a web service kind of API, and maybe I've got some clients that will go there without any library support, say from JavaScript, you know, just make a RESTful kind of post to do whatever it is. But for other languages, maybe you've got statically typed languages in particular, you generate some class libraries, makes the world easier to use. It would be really nice to have more standardized ways of saying, well, here's the documentation, and you can just flick through the tabs to see samples and you know what this is going to do. But still have some bits, there will always be some bits that are specific to that language.
Yeah, of course.
So again, yeah, this is very selfish. This is what I'm doing, is making the client libraries for C# on GCP as nice as I can make them. So that's improving our code gen, working with a colleague to improve the code gen mostly, and then I'm writing just little handcrafted bits to just take some rough edges off.
Sure.
So I see real needs for documentation there, but it feels like maybe the .NET Foundation can be something that can help to drive an industry-wide. So it shouldn't be leading and saying, right, tell you what, we'll prototype for .NET, and then maybe it'll work for other languages later. I would love to see something cross-language, cross-platform, and geared towards an open-source world. So it's staggeringly difficult these days to start an open source project and end up with something that's appealing. So writing the code is the easy bit.
Oh, I know.
It's right, you've got to sort CI, and it's dead easy to get started with CI, but then you need to make a tweak. So you need a build script that doesn't work quite like the build scripts of other things. And so, yeah, my own build scripts for the GCP stuff are written in Bash, but not running on Bash on Windows, because that can't start MS Build, etc. at the moment, which I gather is happening.
So yeah, it is.
We're using the Bash that comes with Git, and that works very well. But there's build scripts. We've got some documentation things. We're using DocFX at the moment, and I've got some custom code that means I've got a separate project for each of these APIs. So like the Google Speech API, speech recognition. I will write some snippets that are written as integration tests, but with some sort of delimiters around bits saying, just associate this bit of snippet with this method in the API documentation. So I've had to write some build processing to extract that out, put it into the API reference docs. I think it's a fabulous way of making sure that my samples not only compile, but actually work. You know, we've got actual tests. But it's all stuff I've had to do. For Nodatime, I've had loads of bits and pieces of extra, oh, let's keep all the versions together and things. It should be easier than this.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
With open source being the way the world is going, has gone, however far you want to think, it should be easier to say, I would like an open source project that has hooks for doing genuinely custom stuff, but has a sort of table stakes, here's a simple website, ideally one that allows you to do other stuff. So I'm currently using Jekyll to generate the documentation for Nodatime, but I'm moving towards an ASP.NET Core application, ideally to host it all. I still want to write in Markdown, but I'd love it to all be hosted in ASP.NET Core so I don't have yet another build. If you look at all the technologies involved in just running the Nodatime website, it's just crazy. I need to install Ruby and Python to get Jekyll with some of the code. No. I don't want to be doing anything with Ruby and Python because I don't know them well enough. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of either of them. I know there are people who are, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But they probably don't want to be writing C# for their build scripts either.
Right.
So, you know, there's some way to go.
I love DocFX, but you feel like there could be more than that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And there are some bits that will be easy, and some bits that will be very, very hard. There are questions around, do you maintain documentation for every version you publish separately? And if I'm linking to something, so say, I'm using JSON.NET from Nodatime. I would like to be able to link in my documentation to say, you know, this takes whatever JSON settings, and I would like to link to the JSON.NET documentation. And if we're, at least if we're using the same documentation system, that should be feasible. But do I link to some notion of latest stable or latest unstable, or the version of JSON.NET that I'm targeting, which may not be the same version of JSON.NET that the person's using? There's hard stuff, and as always, hard stuff is around versioning because it's a nightmare. But
I'm thinking about just the state of, because you would need to have everyone agree when you write open source, do it this way with this kind of documentation.
Right.
Then you'd have to have them agree to maintain documentation in separate versions, and then you'd have to have APIs,
a URL scheme
that links to.
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And by the way, I would love it if that kind of thing happened. I would love it if MSDN embraced the same thing. And then, if everything that's producing readable HTML also has an API, just imagine if you're on Stack Overflow and you say, I want to insert a documentation link, and you can just start typing, and it'll give you a little preview, and then you just say, yep, that's the one.
That would be impressive. And at Microsoft, we do have a new initiative called docs.microsoft.com, where we're trying to get into that kind
of... Right. And I've been intrigued. I don't know whether that's built on top of DocFX, because DocFX is another Microsoft thing. So I don't know whether it's an outflow of that or whatever. But I hope that whatever it is, Microsoft will recognize that actually other people have uses for documentation as well. This probably isn't intellectual crown jewels. Please let us all have good docs.
I'm pretty sure they're using DocFX.
Good.
And
good.
So, I mean, I use DocFX too for my open source library.
And I found
part of my build script.
Hats off to the DocFX team. They have been super super responsive when I file bugs or file feature requests around, you know, well, how do I generate one site that contains multiple versions? Because then all your UIDs that are generated based on just the type name or whatever, well, they're not so unique anymore, because strangely enough, I have the same types in 1.0 and 1.1 and whatever. So yeah, they're working on ways to do that kind of thing. But yeah, it feels like DocFX could still use a little bit more love, a few more people working on it, really make this the way that
get it a fighter's chance, a puncher's chance.
Yeah. And that's still sort of .NET specific, or at least .NET targeted. This pipe dream of a cross-platform, cross-language, which definitely smacks of the XKCD. Oh, there are 11 competing standards. I will come up with, oh, there are now 12 competing standards.
It's like we need the Esperanto of languages to be able to talk.
So I was talking with someone about this yesterday, and it's almost like we need the IL of documentation.
Right.
Some sort of intermediate language that is sufficiently neutral but sufficiently nuanced. So it needs to be a first-class citizen. Every language has to be a first-class citizen with its own little nuances, but in a sufficient...
That's a difficult problem.
And it's an unsexy problem.
Yes.
People don't sort of think, do you know what's going to change the world? Documentation. But it could. It reminds me a little bit of, there was an episode of The West Wing, really near the end of the whole show, where CJ Craig was being asked, you know, right, I'm a billionaire, I would like to hire you. What could I do with $3 billion that would most help Africa? I just said, build roads. No one wants to do it because, you know, it's not the sexy, it's not curing malaria, but if you build roads, it enables so many other things. So I think documentation is like the building roads of software engineering. We're in that awful situation where it's not really good enough, but actually moving the needle will be hard, and no one's quite willing to do it.
Well, there is a whole team, and I know this team is very dedicated at Microsoft, the docs team, and they're expanding like crazy.
Right.
We'll make sure to tell them this.
Yeah. But it's docs infrastructure. Yeah. I'm really, really buzzed that Microsoft has certainly embraced, yeah, we need good documentation for .NET Core, partly because you're trying to reach out to people who haven't previously used .NET, which is great. More sales for C# in depth in the end, you know?
Yeah, of course.
It's good. But it's not just writing the docs, it's making sure the infrastructure is great and available to everyone. So yeah, please pass that on. And I'm hoping that maybe the .NET Foundation would be quite a good
catalyst.
Agency to help that kind of thing.
So it must be fun for you, because you've been doing C# forever. I mean, I bought the C# in depth, the first edition many years ago. C# in depth, second edition. Now you're working on the fourth edition. It must be really fun to be able to use C# and work on C# where you work.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, the one downside is I can't stand up at the conference on stage and say, right, how many of you are professional C# developers? And, you know, people raise their hand and I say, I'm just an amateur, which has always been fun. You know, I'm keeping my amateur status for C# Olympics.
Now he's no longer an amateur.
I am no longer an amateur. I am genuinely a professional C# developer. Fantastic. It's awesome. I have been having the world's greatest time. So, you know, you mentioned Chris Hells earlier on. He's my product manager. We have a blast. We have Chris Smith is my manager, and you know, Chris Smith of F# fame. Ex-Microsoft, bunch of ex-Microsoft people. At one point, I think I was the only one in the team who hadn't worked for Microsoft. That's no longer the case, but yeah, we have a really good set of people. We're very, very customer focused. Our previous team lead, we were hiring a new colleague, you know, internally to the team. And he said, John, can you have a chat with this guy? And all I want to know is, will he fight for the customer? It wasn't, you know, does he have loads of experience in C#? He built his own CLR for fun.
Well, that is a lot of C# experience.
He knew what he was doing anyway. But the main thing was, will he do the right thing for the customer rather than what's easy and what fits in with Google? No, let's just get things right. Don't require me to install a bunch of things. And there are times where there have been compromises we've had to make, really difficult engineering trade-offs. Protocol buffers is the most obvious example of that. A previous version of Protobuf that I did the C-sharp port back in Proto 2 when Protobuf was first open sourced. I did this as a 20% project, and I followed the Java pattern of making everything immutable. And I love, you know, I love my immutability. Mm-hmm. But it is a bit of a pain to work with.
Yeah.
Whereas with object initializers and connection initializers, I should just be able to say new and just here's some stuff. And you can kind of do that with the builder pattern, but you've got to do new person.builder and then call.build at the end. And it ends up, it just looks crufty. It's ceremony that we don't need. And I still thoroughly believe in the virtues of immutability. And there have been times where I've cursed that decision, but it lowers the bar for entry. Yeah. And that's, it's really important.
And so you got to do what's right for the customer, even though it might...
What's right for a certain class of customer, where more experienced customers may well be saying, why is this mutable? John, what are you thinking about? Are you nuts? No. We're just trying to make it as easy to use as possible. And there are pain points in that. And there are places where we've gone back in the gRPC-based APIs and said, you know what? Okay, the protobufs are mutable. They will be mutable. There's nothing we can do around that. You know, if C-sharp 9 comes up with something around immutability that makes it more part of an idiomatic way of using C-sharp, sure, I'll have a whole other project. That's fine. But for the moment where we've got some handwritten types that maybe we can do custom things with to make sure they're easy enough to use anyway. So we have a bunch of call settings. You're making an RPC, and most of the time you can just go with the defaults, but sometimes you want to provide a cancellation token or you want to authenticate as the end user rather than as your service or whatever. We can make those easy enough to use, and you very rarely want to use more than one of those settings at a time. So we can do a bunch of static factory methods. Great. But making those immutable really helps all kinds of things. It's slightly different for your general DTOs for Protobuf. So yeah, there's a lot of making sure it all works really well for the customer.
It's like we need an async for immutability. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because asynchronous callbacks and stuff was really hairy.
Right.
But then once you did the async keyword and there's its handle over there and sort of the state machine, it might be nice to have like an immutable something.
Well, and the C-sharp team, not thinking around quite those lines, although I'm intrigued now and I'll go away and think, what could we do that would be like async that allows you to write almost mutable code and just say, oh, but by the way, this should all be immutable. I know the C-sharp team has worked a lot on record types. They were going to be in C-sharp 6. They were pulled. It wasn't right. It wasn't baked just yet.
Yeah.
They got something that was baked enough. We were able to use it. And I remember I wrote a blog post saying, this wouldn't work for me at the moment because, hey, you've got to have, there were primary constructors, they were called at the time, and you had to have it public. It's like, well, no, bunch of my types in Noda time, I only ever have private constructors, but I still want the benefits of record types in other ways, so it doesn't work for me. And I'm sure there were many, many other bits of feedback that were taken into account, but I know that the C-sharp team heard that feedback and everything else and eventually said, yeah, no, this isn't right yet, we'll pull it for the moment. They tried to revisit it in C-sharp 7. Nope, there are still too many hairy issues that we need to think through. Who knows, maybe it'll be in C-sharp 8.
Nice. We'll see. So speaking of C-sharp,
Tell
us a little bit about some of the features that you're most excited about that have just come out with C-sharp 7.
So, well, it's going to be interesting to see what's actually in C-sharp 7. There's still only the release candidate. And as far as I can tell, there's custom async stuff, which I'm sort of excited about. It's really nice. I expect very, very few people will directly use it. A little bit like Roslyn. Uh-huh. Roslyn's a great thing for everyone who uses Visual Studio. Very few people will write to the Roslyn API, but it's good that the Roslyn API exists. Similarly, writing your own custom async types instead of using task of T. Most people won't need to write their own one, but a load of people using .NET Core and ASP.NET Core will return value task of T instead of task of T. And that's great, but I don't think that's in the release candidate, as far as I can see. At least I've got code that I think should compile, and it doesn't.
Uh-oh.
So, you know. But other things that I am excited about, tuples, and I'm really excited about pattern matching that's coming. And I can see I've got a bunch of places in Noda time and in some of the GCP code saying, do you know what, as soon as we've got pattern matching in C#, I want to rewrite this code, because it really is, if this condition, then these things, if this condition, these things, if this condition, these things. You're really doing kind of pattern matching. And in some of those cases, it's more than just the conditions. It's, well, if you have pattern matching, it would fill in that blank in a really nice way. So pattern matching is starting in C# 7. I've had some hints, these are not private things. The team has expressed this, that maybe there'll be a C# 7.1, who knows, with, I would guess, some incremental features would include more pattern matching. So we have pattern matching on types at the moment and on constant values. We don't have pattern matching on sub-properties, as far as I've seen. I haven't double-checked. So being able to say, right, so if the value is a one of these where that property is true, then fill in this other variable with the value of that property. And I can see loads of places where that kind of thing, very common in F#, Haskell, that kind of language. And yeah, it's undeniable that C# is borrowing from F#. And I, for one, am very, very glad of that. We let the F# team sort of explore loads of features. And then the C# team says, do you know what, that one looks really useful. We'll mold it, we'll take it, mold it in the C# idiomatic way, and then release stuff. And it seems to be a formula that's working really well.
So what is so you're saying tuples and pattern matching, something we should definitely look at. What is a C# feature that you absolutely think more people should be using?
So my guess is that at any moment in time, it's features from the most recently released version that you're probably using, you're probably able to use, but maybe haven't looked at and actively decided, I will start using that. So in C# 6, there are three features that I have used a lot. One is expression bodied members. So that's where if you've got a read-only property, and in C# 7, there'll be expression bodied everything. So you can do all kinds of stuff. But read-only properties and methods and indexes in C# 6, instead of having to write all the get, return something, you can just use what looks like a lambda expression. It's not. It's just the equals greater than. Yeah. It's the same syntax, but it's not a lambda expression. So you can just write that, and then the value, no return statement, all the cruft goes away, all the ceremony around, well, all I'm trying to express is that this property does that, returns that, and likewise for methods. And I've used it so much in NodaTime. So I use NodaTime as a sort of test bed.
Do you have an example of that?
Let's look in NodaTime itself. I didn't have this example prepped, but looking, I use NodaTime as a test bed for a while. The latest code for NodaTime could only be compiled with a non-stable release of Visual Studio, because Visual Studio 13 was, there was a release candidate for a really long time. But if we look at, let's look at local date time as an example. So a local date time is a date and a time, and it's stored internally, when I can get there. No, not local time pattern. It's stored internally as two fields, a date and a time. It's a crazy notion. But you can get at things like, what's the hour of the day? So if you've got a time field that has its own hour of day, but you want to expose hour of day as a property, it's really natural. You just delegate from one property down to another. Mm-hmm. So you can see all kinds of, if I just find hour. Right, so this is a perfect example. And you can see things above and below that do the exact same job. It's just delegating one property to the same property on a nested field. And it's not just things like that. Other things that actually do computations, I write a lot of read-only properties. The other nice thing in C# 6 is read-only properties can be automatically implemented read-only properties that have a backing read-only field. This is all good. I have been requesting that for like years and years and years. Mm-hmm. So
that's one that everyone should be looking at.
Yeah, and same for methods. It doesn't give you any extra power other than psychological power. One of the bizarre things around expression-bodied members is you look at that, and that almost looks like Haskell. I'm a functional programmer now, right? Yeah. I've like gained 10 IQ points. I'm writing functional code. Well,
but that's not what it is.
It's exactly the same code as it was when, if you had get return, time.hour. That, you know, you're doing exactly the same thing, but that looks nasty.
It doesn't look as cool.
Yeah.
When I do the arrow kind of thing.
I think that there is more than psychological. It really is encouraging you to think of that property as just delegating to. It's not that it does something, it's that it's a shorthand for, almost. It's definitely less imperative. And the same thing is true for, let's find the equals operator. Most of the operators that I've got, so this is the not equal operator, most of the operators that I've got are single expression, and you can implement a bunch of them this way. Equals the method and to string. To string's an interesting one because then a lot of the time I can use string interpolation, a new feature in C# 6.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah. And it's worth exploring interpolated string literals a bit more because there are some hidden depths that I think most people maybe aren't aware of and potentially pitfalls. So if you've got a string.format call or you're doing manual string concatenation, chances are you could use string interpolation there. But be aware that by default, it will use the current culture, which I think was a design mistake back in 1999 or whenever it was first decided. I wish it would use the invariant culture by default. But back then when we were running more code locally rather than, a web server should almost never use the current, certainly not the system current culture,
right.
Maybe the current culture for the request and things. But it will use that current culture for the thread. There's also formattable string. So if you want to use the invariant culture or some other culture, you can use formattable string, which is in .NET 4.6 and .NET Standard 1.3, I think. And there are some subtleties there in terms of the type of an interpolated string literal is string. Okay, so how can I assign it to a formattable string? Oh, well, that's a different kind of conversion. It's a little bit like if I write, let's just put sandbox. So this is just a sandbox method in the middle of node time, which I hope I remember to not commit this.
We won't.
If you write byte b equals 10, okay, you're fine with that. You understand that should compile. What's the type of this literal? It's int.
Yeah.
So I can, if I do int I equals 10 and then byte b equals I, that won't compile. So how did it compile before?
It was an implicit conversion, wasn't it?
But it's an implicit conversion not from the type int to byte. It's an implicit conversion from an expression which is a constant expression of type int that is within the range of byte. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we've got exactly the same thing for formattable strings. So if you do var t equals hello name, and we'll just say string name equals Seth. Okay. Var, that var is a string.
Right.
But if I do formattable string, which probably won't work, it's not supported in everything that I'm targeting, but hey, t2 equals hello name. That's, when you do this assignment, it has to call string.format to do the formatting immediately. In this case, it doesn't. The implicit conversion from the expression string interpolated string literal to formattable string changes what the compiler does with it. A little bit like lambda expressions and expression tree versus exactly. It's very similar to expression trees versus delegates.
Yeah.
So instead of evaluating it all, it says, "Well, I will evaluate name, but I'll create a formattable string with a format that's hello and then in braces zero and then the value of name." And that leads to some interesting. I've got an abuse here that I'll show you. Which I can't decide whether I like this or not. It's really fun, but I don't know whether I'd like it in production code. Mm-hmm. So here's some code.
Hold on 1 second. We're recording a video.
Thank you.
Give me 1 second, but please, you can sit right there, though. Thank you. All right, go ahead.
So if you look at, we've got here, we've got two variables, so a string and an ID that's an integer, and we've got something that looks kind of scary. Okay, if you saw that without anything else in your code base, maybe let's make it more scary because I've sort of given a hint that it's okay. But if you see that in a code base, you should be thinking, "Arg, I've got SQL injection attack." It's like I'm putting the value straight into the SQL. Well, not so much in this case. So you'll see we're not calling new SQL command. as in the constructor, we're calling an extension method newSQL command that takes a formattable string. So that formattable string will have captured the SQL with, instead of name varchar, it will have 0 nvarchar and 1. So it will have captured those, and it will have captured the values of name and ID. And I've got some code that anyone's welcome to use that takes that formattable string and replaces, instead of putting name and ID values, it uses P0, P1, P2, etc. into the SQL. So it creates
a parameterized
one. Yeah. And the format string in here, the bit that is how to format something, well, that's just the SQL DB type. And so we parse that and then set that as the value, as the type in the SQL parameter. So let me run this code. This may come up with a huge font because of the last time I happened to run it. So if we run this code, we'll see this is the SQL that it's actually generated. And these are the two parameters. We've got parameter P0 has a type of nvarchar and a value of John, and it's inferred the int in the normal way that SQL parameter does. That's nothing to do with me, but you could have put int in there instead. So is that, do you like that? Would you like to see that in your code base or not?
I think I'm conflicted, right? Because for one, injection problem. But it looks like you're making it okay.
Right.
And but it's not okay. It
genuinely is making it okay. And not only that, don't you think that's more readable than...
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And this is... If you trust it, it's great. But you need to know to trust it. And you need to be aware. You don't want some... I'm going to rephrase how I would say it. Some less competent developer to say, in that case, interpolated string literals are fine for they're safe for SQL injection. Mm-hmm. So I'll just, in my other project that doesn't have this expression, this extension method, I will just do new SQL command and then blah. It's like, no, don't do that. And static code analysis tools are going to go crazy at this and say, what the heck are you doing?
And so that helps with the subtle difference between string interpolation and a formattable string. They're different things, and you use them differently.
So it's, this is an interpolated string literal being converted, instead of to string, to formattable string. Yeah.
And then you're taking the guts out of it
and
writing it correctly.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
so I think it's lovely, and in certain cases, I'd be happy to see it in production code in a tightly knit team that knew what it was doing. But it would be the first, new member to the team. Right, the first thing you need to know is we have this pattern and it makes the code more readable, but be aware of what it's doing.
Oh my goodness. So that brings us to the next and the last topic. I came here with 2 or 3 years ago and I was next to Dustin Campbell and Kevin Pils-Poisson, who literally work on this.
Yeah.
The compiler stuff.
Absolutely, and they are awesome folks.
And I was sitting next to them and you were giving the first time abusing C#.
Right.
And the guys that were sitting there looking like, oh crap, it does that? It's the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. Why don't you give us some of those tidbits?
So this is a talk called Abusing C#, and in fact, that's the solution we're in. You can see at the top. So this is where I don't know whether this counts as abuse or not, but I've got a few other things. This year I'm doing an Abusing C# more, aiming at the C# 6 and 7
nice.
Features. So that's what the talk's going to be. And again, I don't know whether this is abuse or not. You're logging, okay? You want to do some logging, and you don't want it to be expensive when you're not logging, but you want to give really good log messages as cleanly as possible. Mm-hmm. So very often when you're logging, you don't just say, I've got here, you say, I've got here and these values are this thing. Perfect for interpolated string literals. But you don't want to format the string unless you need it.
Right.
And ideally, you don't even want to create the formattable string, sort of the placeholder ready to do the formatting. Well, we can take advantage of another feature here, which is the null conditional operator.
Elvis.
Also introduced in C# 6. So here I have my own kind of logger. And this is not quite the same as other logging code that you would see, where normally you would do sort of logger.debug and then just put the code in.
Yeah.
Well, here we're doing something slightly different. We've got debug and inflow properties, and these aren't all implemented. Bear in mind, this is not a logging framework that I have come up with. It's a pattern that could be used to build one. And the idea is, maybe this will return null, maybe it won't. So if debug logging isn't enabled, this will return null. At which point the null conditional operator says, oh right, okay, in which, blow that, I'm not gonna bother evaluating any of that. But otherwise it'll say, yeah, okay, I will pass that. And the log method takes takes a formattable string. So if I run this code, where are we? We're still in string interpolation, hooray. If I run, no we're not. Sorry, for some reason I have put this into, it's null conditional because we're
that makes
dealing
sense,
with, Well, it's both features. So if I give logging demo, it's given info and this is the evaluated string, but note this, okay? This is how I would like to see my dates and times in log files. Uh-huh. It's ISO 8601. No one's going to get confused if you as a US citizen give it to me, etc. But here I've just put datetime.net. I haven't changed the culture that my code is running in, but because this takes a formattable string, I can format the message with a specifically crafted logging culture that is based on the invariant culture, but has its date patterns set to be ISO. Oh. So it just magically happens. I don't need to worry about that anywhere in the code that does the logging. It just passes in a date time and it will format it as ISO.
And that's the subtle difference between the log function taking a string and the log function
again,
taking a formattable string,
so
which is
it's got the date time at that point, not formatted yet. Mm-hmm. It can do what it likes.
Yeah. Because it's an expression that you can sort of poke into and do whatever you want.
Well, it's a value by then, mm-hmm. but it's still a date time value rather than being just a string.
Got it. Okay, that's awesome. What other there was this other thing you did, and I don't know how you did it, but you scrolled over a little bit.
Okay, I will show
that. That was the most evil thing I had ever seen. And they were sitting there like, what's going on? And they're like, he scrolled. And then you scrolled over, they're like, oh,
so this is the file, and I always give this first if I'm giving the talk, because I have to go, okay, I have to start the talk with it looking like that. And so this is go to. And I normally actually start with this. So, you know, here's some basic, and it's got 20, 30, go to 20. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get back to those days?
No, and everyone's like, no, don't do it.
And so here we can say go to a line number. And it really does, and I normally change, I'll say, well, if we go to 18 instead, then it'll print hello instead of keep going. Hello and then keep going. And I say, how's this gonna work? And we scroll over, and there's a bunch of awaits. And we notice that it's not the same kind of braces as we'd normally use, because it has to be done in this particular way. I can't remember all the details either.
When you were explaining it, I was like, I don't understand what you did there, but there is something evil happening here. This compiles, by the way, folks.
It uses the line number, but we have no line numbers here. I could copy and paste a line here into later on in the code, and it would still do the right thing, because this underscore is a line action, and line action is a delegate, which, we haven't provided any arguments, but it does have a parameter, which is the line number, but it's using the new at the time call a line number. So the compiler is filling in the line number in the code, and then the rest of it that's really evil is it runs a state machine. So the first time through, it executes all the code, and this is why we need that await at the start of every line. Mm-hmm. It has to say, okay, I'm not going to evaluate. I'm going to remember where I got to, but not come back to there. And I would have to look at the code. It took a long time to write this.
It took a long time for me to look at it and then just be like, I don't understand.
So what you need to understand is that when you have an async method, that builds a state machine.
Of course.
And it builds a state machine where it's represented as you've got some fields, which is all your local variables, mm-hmm. and there's one local variable, which is the state, the next state that you will come into. When it's running, it's irrelevant, but when you await and it says, okay, I need to pause now. It's got to remember where to come back to. And at the start of the method, there's a switch statement that says, oh, you came back to state number three. I'll drop down into here. So if you have a state machine where there's one of these sort of pseudo entry points for every line, then all you've got to do is be able to persuade the state machine it needs to resume at that line. And, you know, this is just a regular C-sharp struct. I think it's a struct. Yeah, it's a struct, and it gets boxed and some crazy stuff. So I have some async state machine extensions that allow me to get the current state. So when I'm running through it for the first time, line number 10, what state does that correspond to? Well, I'll just call getState, and it gets the reflection based, uses reflection to get the field that's being used for that. And then I have setState that allows me to poke at it and say, do you know what? I don't care where we are waited, you're going to resume over here.
It's and just so that's pure how it evil. Works. And I remember like when you scrolled over, they all went, oh my goodness.
But it still doesn't make sense until you then go into the state machine. Like, and there's like, more and more science.
But the thing is, they understood right when you moved it over, they were like, oh, he's messing with the state machine.
Oh no, I think they got, okay, well, that's how they got some aspects. Mm-hmm. But it's a multi-leveled thing, this. And I spent a bunch of time messing with state machines. I don't know where I got the time now, looking back on it. Because I had, there are some things I'll do with resuming states. And
looks like a lot of effort to just make GoTo work.
Which is
what it should be. It should take a lot of effort to make GoTo
work. So there's retry. So you can, here's the retrying example. So you can say, await, just retry this a few times. If it goes bang, then just come back to here and try again.
Wow.
And I don't know where my come from went, but I had come from so that you could have multiple methods and you could go to a different method. And it's just, go to method async. Here we go. Yeah. So, and again, you scroll over a bit. I think I must have reformatted it at some point. So you can go to line one within the bar method and it will go into here and just... evil.
This is available, right? People can look at this.
Oh, yeah, this is all on github.com/jskeet/demo code, and it's in the abusing C-sharp folder. But this is not for production use,
it shouldn't be, people should not be able to look at this, but it is amazing to look at how you sort of went into the internals of the state machine, which is what async await does, and then you've been able to do whatever you want.
One thing, when C-sharp 7 has custom state machines, or rather, it will build a state machine for you for a custom awaitable task. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at the details enough to know whether that will have whole new abuses, but it'll be fun, I'm sure.
So to finish up, when can we expect your next edition of C# in depth?
I have written the C# 6 stuff. So the third edition finished with C# 5.
Right.
And then I didn't do one just for C# 6, so the fourth edition will cover C# 6 and 7, and we're keeping the C# 5 stuff, which will, some of the async stuff will have new bits and pieces, but I'm ditching all the 2, 3, and 4, because I don't want the book to be like that thick. So it's going to be basically C# 5, 6, 7. I finished writing the C# 6 stuff, so I'm hoping that there'll be an early access edition covering just C# 6 sometime this month.
Nice.
Fingers crossed. And then I will write the C# 7 stuff, then I'll revisit the C# 5 stuff. Publishing dates are hard.
Yeah.
But dates and times in general are hard. Publishing dates are a whole different category. Maybe I need a Noda Time thing where, you know, there's publishing calendar that just gives you a random date that's always, 6 to 8 weeks or whatever.
Nice.
I'm hoping it'll be sometime in 2017.
So look out for the EAP on Manning.com.
Yes, absolutely.
Make sure you get that going. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, John.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Always fun.
And if, again, you want to reach him, just write a really good question on Stack Overflow. He'll probably answer before you even hit enter. Thanks so much for spending some time
with us.
Thanks so much for watching. My name is Seth Juarez from Channel 9. We're here at Code Mash in Sandusky, Ohio. We'll see you next time. Take care.